Hey, welcome to the TEEP podcast brought to you by CECO and UH Energy. I'm your host, Gary Gildert, and today we have an interview with Todd McAllister, the Chief Executive Officer of the South Central Partnership for Energy Efficiency as a resource, also known as SPEER. Todd, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, Gary, thanks for having me today. I look forward to our discussion. I'm a West Texas kid, grew up out in West Texas, have been in Austin in a couple of different capacities for the last almost 26 years. I grew up in the HVAC industry, so I'm was kind of, I guess, on the peripheral of energy efficiency back in the day. And the company that I was with, which was my father's company, we actually were maybe a little bit ahead of our curve whenever you're looking at efficiency and some of the things we did back in the day. So that kind of drove some of my interest in efficiency, which kind of moved me to SPEER after that.
Okay, that's from the supplier side, some people will argue, oh, you're upselling. No, you're providing some value to them. So I appreciate that point of view on there. So tell me a little bit about SPEER. I know you did a webinar recently, and I encourage people to go back and listen to the ETI webinar. But for those who haven't, tell us a little bit about SPEER.
So we are a regional energy efficiency organization. There are six of us across the country, and you can think about basically the areas that they would be in: Northwest, Northeast, Midwest, Southeast. We're SPEER, the South Central Partnership. We are only Texas and Oklahoma. That is our region.
That's a big region in itself, so.
It is. We have, you know, roughly 11% of the total population of the country in those two states, the majority in Texas, obviously. But yeah, we have a large portion of the population. But SPEER is, as I said, a regional energy efficiency organization. We work within the built environment. We do a lot of trainings around building codes and energy efficiency and those type of activities. We work pretty closely with the Public Utility Commission and the utility energy efficiency programs. We work with local governments and universities and anybody that's interested in energy efficiency, we're willing to work with them. And that's kind of what our stalwart is.
Okay, that sounds like a great mission. And that's how we met, because certainly TEEP, the University of Houston, overlaps very positively with the work that SPEER is doing. So I have to ask, where do you get all your money from? Are you just a lobbying company?
We are not. So we are that's a good question. I appreciate that. We are a 501c3, so we technically, by law, do not lobby. We do advocacy around educational components of what we do. We do a lot of, you know, white papers and those kind of things to kind of educate legislators and folks on what's going on. But our money actually is kind of a four-potted approach. We do have private grant funding that we get from folks that are interested in, you know, our mission and what we do and helping to serve. We have membership money that comes in. We have roughly 75 members, some of them smaller, some of them larger. Daikin, you know, the largest manufacturer of HVAC equipment, is a member of SPEER. We do have federal contracts and state contracts that we get. Some of them we are the prime, and others we are not the prime. We're a subcontractor for other folks. We do a lot of, as I said, work around and trainings when it comes to building and energy codes. And then the last pot is just kind of a ancillary pot where we do, you know, a big workshop during the year and those kind of things that have some funding. So really it's kind of a, I would say 40% of our funding is either private grant funding or membership in the events that we do. And then about 60% is through contracts, either us being the prime on a contract or our subcontracting.
Okay, that's a wide range of funding sources. So you're not beholden to any one party. That's always good to hear. So of all the energy efficiency initiatives that you have, what do you think is most popular? What do you end up spending most of your time on?
Well, popularity for us and popularity for the population are probably two different things.
Okay, well, then you can answer it both ways.
Yeah, so the thing that we are the best at and that we're really known for is our code work. We do a lot of building and energy code work. We have trained over the last 10 years, basically more than 15,000 folks that are in the building industry. Now, they can be contractors, installers, HVAC folks, framers, insulators. They could be people like you that are just interested in what's going on and that take our, you know, would take one of our trainings. So we've trained a lot of people around building code and building science and energy codes. That's different, I think, than what the population, if you just talk about the general population, right? They're more interested in things like, how do I make my home more efficient? What can I do around those type of activities? And so for us, we walk the line about, you know, professionals and those that we consider to be subject matter experts that we work with on codes, and then having information also that is out there that can help just the regular everyday Texan or Oklahoman whenever it comes to what they're interested in finding out about efficiency.
So one of the other questions that I have that I think came out of the out of your webinar was the idea of demand response and distributed generation. These are not, in my mind, these are not energy efficiency things, but I love the way that it overlaps with energy efficiency. So just when I was at the Texas Energy Summit, there was a great example of, yeah, they went in for distributed distribution. They wanted to put in their own energy source, and they found that they could put in a lot less equipment if they just do better with what they've got, improve the efficiency of the facility, and suddenly they have to build less. Do you see this it the same way, that energy efficiency is a way to get better demand response, better distributed?
Yes, I think the short answer is yes. I think the long answer is trying to figure out how to braid these together. How do you braid things like demand response and you know, flexibility, demand flexibility, and, you know, folks moving what they're charging to an off period and an off peak period, those type of things, and efficiency then playing into that. I think the largest component of demand response and efficiency is a smart thermostat. You know, so many people have smart thermostats and then so many people don't. But smart thermostat really is kind of like, I would say, the basic start for demand response and efficiency tying in together, where you can leave your home and raise your thermostat a little bit, or you can be home and lower it back down, or, you know, you can pre-cool your home before you get home from work, or before, you know, all of the things that can work within that. Then it also has a component, right, that if we have problems on the grid, that you can sign up potentially for demand response programs from your local utility, who would then be able to kind of control your thermostat, which...
Yeah, that's a scary proposition for most people. I don't see that being very popular in Texas.
I think it is. It's more popular than you think. I think the problem is that the actual payment that goes back to the customer is probably not enough. You know, a lot of these programs are $25 or $35 or $40 a year is what the customer is getting. And really, you know, for a demand response program like that to be successful, as you said, we're in Texas. It's going to be 9,000 degrees tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day. Is it's always hot. People don't want anybody messing with their thermostat. But if the payment was more, you know, more appropriate, I think, where you're talking about, let's say that it was almost a full, you know, let's say a half of a electric bill payment for the year. Now you're talking about real money, right? So I think there are ways to work with that.
Okay. Yeah. I think that'll be one of the challenges of the future with these, with the retail energy providers, to see if they can figure out a program that's going to work for folks.
100%.
So resistance heaters seem to be a thing in Texas and the way things were built. But by my calculations, and I think you can tell me the same thing, that a 5-kilowatt heater can be replaced with a 2-kilowatt heat pump.
Yep.
There's, for one, that's a big reduction in the peak demand in the winter. And the second thing, this is real savings, is it not, for the homeowner, for the apartment dweller?
It is.
Or the person who has to pay for this electricity.
Yeah, so, you know, we have really been pushing hard over the last half decade to try to get heat pumps into the marketplace. About 60% of the homes in Texas have what you consider to be a strip heat, which is just a giant toaster, right? I mean, it's the same kind of element that your toaster uses to toast your bread, or used in a home to heat the home. There's no partiality to it. There's no variableness to it. Basically, when it comes on, it's the full 5 kW. There's no, I can put on one or I can put on two. It's all of it coming on at one time. So there have been several...
That's bad controls even. Yes. Trailers, they can even fix the controls.
There's a lot of studies that have come out that said that us going to heat pumps in Texas on some of these, and we did a study last year with Aurora Energy out of Austin where we discussed this very thing and talked about a 20, 40, 60, 80, 100% adoption of heat pumps and getting the resistance heat off. And the long and short is on most of these studies, we're talking about saving conservatively probably about 12,000 megawatts. Now, you know, our peak in the summertime is about 85, almost 86,000 megawatts. Our peak in the winter is high 70s. So that winter resistance heat that is being used, you're talking about now pulling us back to this into the 60s on this if heat pumps were to be used. Not only that, we're talking about a savings for most people, disposable income going into their pocket and then back into the economy of anywhere between $300 and $450 a year. That they could save by not having this resistance heat in either their apartment or their home or wherever they're utilizing the resistance heat. It's a big issue. It's a big problem in Texas. It's one that I think is going to have to be legislatively probably fixed in the future. But yeah, it could save a lot of people a lot of money, and more importantly, it could save capital investment on our grid if we're pulling that power off and not having to use it. So,
that opens up a whole. Whole bunch of parts of the discussion. So one of the things that I heard of at, again, the Texas Energy Summit, and that I've been thinking about, is the whole split incentives that the builder of apartment rental property, whether it's residential or commercial, their objective is to build it as cheap as possible. You have to build it to code. And I can appreciate your argument of, yeah, we have to work on the codes that allow this to happen. But their incentive is to build it as cheap as possible. And they're not the ones who pay the utility bills.
Right.
It's the renter who pays the utility bills.
Right.
Well, if I use the example of, and I'll use myself in this example, because I just installed a heat pump. In the fall, and compared to the air conditioner, it cost me an extra $2,000 to put in my heat pump. Well, that if it was that 2 kilowatt heat pump, the 2 kilowatts cost me an extra $2,000. If I were to finance that over 10 years at a reasonable interest rate, that's just over $20 a month. Well, compared to a resistance heater. I'm just going to go off the numbers that you have. That could be $40 a month.
It could be.
And so, okay, so let's see. A lease payment of $20 a month saves $40 a month. The economics are insane on that. You should be doing that. But it's the person who's saving the money isn't the same one who has to spend the money.
Right.
I wish there was some way we can close that gap. Any thoughts, any ideas?
Yeah. I've got a lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts. I don't know that any of them are feasible in Texas right now, but
trying to promote some of these. I'm all ears.
Yeah. So, you know, we have utility programs here in Texas, and everybody that's in what is considered to be the IOU or the ERCOT market, which is about 90% of Texans are in the ERCOT market. And it's the big areas, and it's the center points and the Encores and the Energies and those kind of people that are part of this IOU. Everybody on their bill has a charge basically that goes towards energy efficiency. This was all set up at the turn of the century, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but it was back in the 97, 99 time, whenever we deregulated our electric market here in Texas. So there's a charge on there, and that charge is got a cost cap to it that basically by legislation and by rule through the Public Utility Commission, it can only be so much. And we're not advocating for that cost cap to go up to, $5 or $6 a month. I think we would all say that there are a lot of people that would be a really detrimental expense. Mm-hmm. And we are very cognizant of that. We're also cognizant of the fact, though, that like nickels and dimes are things that end up when you're talking about millions of customers adding up to real money. How do you potentially modify that cost cap and then modify the utility programs to put in pilot programs or programs that are specific to reach made to reach hard to reach customers or low income, the customers a lot of times who really could benefit from, as you said, you know, changes within their apartment building or changes within their rental unit that they have. So how does that, how do those utility programs then braid in with potentially federal programs such as LIHEAP and those things to help a landlord or a building owner pay for upgrades either at the beginning where it's cheaper, much cheaper to do it at the beginning than it is to try to retrofit, to pay for these at the beginning, get the landlord where he or she is able to recoup the whatever the difference is to make sure that it's cost effective for them so it doesn't affect the rent. But then on the flip side, those individuals in perpetuity, right? At least until you have to change out systems and those things, everybody that lives in that apartment benefits from what has been done. So if I'm only there for a year, I get a year's benefit. If somebody else is there for 2 years, they get 2 years benefit. And so there's, I think it's got to be, you know, it's going to be have to be creative in Texas because we don't have a lot of the same programs that they have in other parts of the country that maybe look at efficiency differently, right? And so I think there are creative ways to look at it, but it's something, you've got a lot of renters in Texas and we are becoming a transient state. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of people in and out that are renting and, you know, not only just apartments, but homes. And how do you make this more beneficial for everybody?
Yeah, not everyone was lucky enough to be born in Texas. We just got here as quickly as we could.
I have one of those in my household.
So a thought occurred to me is, do the utility companies, the generators, have a role to play in this? Because their incentive is to build more capacity. And if you look at a new apartment or a new small rental property, they're going to make more money from a 5-kilowatt toaster than they are from the 2-kilowatt heat pump.
Yeah.
Why not have them pay for the heat pump and collect the lease payment?
I think there's opportunities. I think there's opportunities for everything to be on the table. You know, with us having the three-legged stool in Texas with the generators, you know, because we're deregulated, you have the generators who make the power and we're a day ahead market, basically still, it's kind of pseudo. Then you have the T&D transmission distribution folks like the Encore and CenterPoint. And then, as you mentioned earlier, you have the reps. So that you actually would purchase your power through, it's the rep if you're in one of the ERCOT market participants. So I think there's got to be a way to make it so that everybody has some type of skin in the game, right? For a utility or a generator, in essence, with all the people coming to Texas and the growth in Texas and everything that's happening, is it a zero net sum gain? Do I understand that they have investors? That's why they're called investor-owned utilities, that they have investors that they have to have to answer to? 100%. But if your energy efficiency is saving on capital infrastructure, which in essence is passed on to the consumer because we pay for that. If you're not having to do capital infrastructure, which is saving, you know, admin cost and everything that go along with it because you've pulled a little power off of the system, I think it makes some of those creative options easier to digest as you continue to grow because your service territory is going to get more and more power into your service territory. We just have to figure out where's the middle line where you're pulling enough power off to make sure that everybody is benefiting from efficiency. You're not having to pay for capital infrastructure because you're kind of meeting the demand with what you have right now. And then how do you keep the investors, you know, where they're happy and you don't have, you know, boardrooms and things like that that are wanting to, you know, explode because they're not getting a return on their dollar. So, Texas is an interesting state when it comes to this. So, I think there's opportunities. I don't have the answer to what those opportunities are, but I think everybody needs to get in the room and discuss it.
Yeah. Can we convince these utility companies to invest in heat pumps instead of the next gas power plant?
Yeah. No, I think that's
a tough thing for them to do, but I think that could be a good business for them because it turns over every 10 years.
It is, and it does. And we actually have a training. We've worked very closely with CenterPoint, and they do a great job in their heat pump programs. We've got a training that we're doing in Houston with contractors in May the 13th, that's dealing with heat pumps and why these are important. And so I think, you know, those utilities such as CenterPoint and some of the other, well, you know, the municipal utilities like Austin Energy and CPS in San Antonio are really kind of ahead of the curve on this. But yeah, I think there's ample opportunity, and I think they're willing to look and figure out how to make all of this work. It's just, again, at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of moving parts that come with this.
Yeah, we have to somehow make heat pumps a thing that utilities want.
Well, and I would hope the state wants them. I mean, we do have, Daikin.
Yeah.
Daikin is the second largest manufacturing plant, I think, in North America that sits in Waller right outside of Houston. It's
I know.
huge. So I would hope that the state would like to, have them be as benef you know, make have them benefit as much as they can. And there's other manufacturers, Trane and, that's here in Texas, and Mitsubishi and LG and all the other folks that make heat pumps, they should be part of the process as well.
Absolutely. It's in their interest. We just have to get everyone's incentives aligned.
100%. I think that's a great way of putting it.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good way to end this conversation. Todd, it's always a pleasure. We will probably be speaking offline at other times because I'm really interested in all the work that you're doing and do whatever I can to support your organization.
Great. I appreciate it, Gary. We really do appreciate the partnership.
Okay, thanks, Todd. So this has been the TEEP Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gildert. We are sponsored by the State Energy Conservation Office in Austin, Texas, and UH Energy. Again, thank you, Todd, for coming on our show.